today on Path of Grace.
Jesus says, okay, guys, here's the deal. You want to stone her for her sin? Go for it. That's what Moses calls for. And if you're really gung-ho for the law of Moses, that's great. Excellent. Way to go. High five. Good for you. If you are all about making sure that anyone and everyone who has ever done anything worthy of punishment gets what's coming to them, go for it. Let's do that. Let's uphold the law of Moses. If you're truly concerned about honoring God by executing anyone and everyone who has ever done anything worthy of death according to the law, let's do it. And everyone is free to take part. If you guys are super gung-ho about killing this guilty, sinful, dirty woman, then hey, you're all free to take part. Woo-hoo! But just one condition. Let the first rock be thrown by the one of you who is absolutely without sin. Let it be thrown by the one who could never be accused of anything like this woman has. Let's start it out this way. That's how we're going to start this rock concert. Let that person throw the first stone. And then it says, he stooped back down and began to write in the dirt again with his finger. So what did he write?
Don't want to wait till tomorrow. Why put it off another day? One by one, little problems build up and stand in our way. Oh, one step ahead, one step ahead.
Open up whichever translation of the Bible you happen to have handy to the Gospel of John, chapter 8. Today we are once again going to be looking at verses 2 through 11, and I'll be reading from the New King James Version, just because that's what I have handy, and it's sitting here beside me. Now, there's a couple things I want to touch on today that we didn't talk about last time, and that's why we're coming back to this passage one more time. Let's start in verse 2. Now, early in the morning, Jesus came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. So at this point, Jesus is becoming fairly popular with the common people. He goes into the temple early in the morning, and the attention is focused on him. All the people in the temple, they come and they gather around him, which is something that really had to irritate the religious leaders. In fact, at this point, they have it in for him already, which is what leads them to do what we see next in this passage. Look at verse 3. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery, in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say?" This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. Now, this question they ask Jesus is a total setup. It's intended to trap him. They're trying to put him really into a lose-lose situation. See, depending on his answer, he could end up alienating himself from the crowds who had been touched by his compassion and mercy, or his response could get him in hot water with the religious leaders and perhaps labeled as a heretic if he did or said anything that belittled or contradicted the law of Moses. Now, think about it. If Jesus said, "Okay, guys, let's go ahead and have a rock concert. Go ahead and stone her," that probably would have turned the stomachs of a lot of the people, the crowds that had been attracted to him because of his talk of mercy and grace. However, if he simply said, "Oh, come on, guys, let's just give her another chance. How about we just let this slide?" The religious leaders would then have immediately labeled him as a blasphemer or a false prophet for not taking the law of Moses seriously. Now, the first part of verse 6 lets us know that they weren't really concerned about upholding the law. That wasn't their main focus. They were simply looking for something to accuse Jesus of. Hauling this lady in would have probably never crossed their minds had they not been wanting to set up Jesus. Look at verse 6 again. This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. Again, they weren't concerned with what's good or what's right. They were just wanting to accuse. They were looking for any excuse to diminish the view of Christ that the common people had for him at this point. This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. Then the rest of verse 6, I love this. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear. I love the way Jesus dealt with these people. They throw this lady at his feet. They want him to make a judgment call. They're looking for something to accuse him of. And they're using this woman as a pawn in their sick game, trying to use her moral failures, her sin, her heartache, really, as a tool for them to make Christ look bad and make themselves look better. And really what this is, it's exploitation of this woman, using another person for their own agenda, for their own purposes, ultimately for their own gain. And Jesus sees right through it. There are other passages where the religious leaders are messing with Christ, and Scripture tells us things like Jesus, knowing their hearts, responded and said, see, Jesus knew their hearts. He saw right through them. He knew exactly what was going on. But rather than just immediately verbally tearing them down, he stoops down and starts drawing in the dirt with his finger as though he did not hear. Now, what was Jesus writing in the dirt? It doesn't tell us. But I've got a theory. Before we talk about it, look at verse 7. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, he who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. And again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Wow. He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. Who would qualify to throw the first stone at this point? In reality, nobody, if people are honest. Jesus says, okay, guys, here's the deal. You want to stone her for her sin? Go for it. That's what Moses calls for. And if you're really gung-ho for the law of Moses, that's great. Excellent. Way to go. High five. Good for you. If you are all about making sure that anyone and everyone who has ever done anything worthy of punishment gets what's coming to them, go for it. Let's do that. Let's uphold the law of Moses. If you're truly concerned about honoring God by executing anyone and everyone who has ever done anything worthy of death according to the law, let's do it. And everyone is free to take part. If you guys are super gung-ho about killing this guilty, sinful, dirty woman, then hey, you're all free to take part. Woo-hoo! But just one condition. Let the first rock be thrown by the one of you who is absolutely without sin. Let it be thrown by the one who could never be accused of anything like this woman has. Let's start it out this way. That's how we're going to start this rock concert. Let that person throw the first stone. And then it says, he stooped back down and began to write in the dirt again with his finger. So what did he write? Doesn't tell us specifically. There's a passage, though, in the book of Jeremiah that might be a prophecy that could possibly give us an idea of what Jesus was writing at this point. In Jeremiah, I think it's chapter 17, around verse, I don't know, 12 or 13, it says something like, those who depart from me shall be written in the earth. Now, had the religious leadership at this point, the scribes and the Pharisees, had they departed from Father, in a sense? I think so. They lost the heart of God. And maybe, this is just speculation, when Jesus first stooped down, what if he wrote the names of these guys in the dirt? Pharisee James, Pharisee Tim, Pharisee Brian, Pharisee Chris. What if that's what he did when he stooped down the first time? Just jotted down their names. And then what if, when he stooped down and started to write the second time, these guys sort of thought, well, what is he writing? And they began to look over his shoulder into the dirt. And what if beside their names, he wrote very specific sins, secret things, things they thought no one else knew about? What if the sin he wrote beside those names was adultery? What if some of these very men had spent their own time in the past with a woman they had flung at Jesus' feet? Who knows? I think this could be a possibility of what was going on. And imagine what it would do in your heart if you looked down with your stone in hand and you saw your name written in the dirt. And as you held onto that rock ready to kill this woman for her sin, besides your name, Jesus jots down rebellion toward parents, disrespectful to parents, or maybe that secret something you thought no one knew about from 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years earlier with a woman just like this woman. Let him who has no sin cast the first stone. I wonder if you'd say, yikes, I've got a roast in the oven. Gotta go, guys. What if your secret sin was something worthy of death? You know, I mentioned just a moment ago, rebellion toward parents. Did you know in the law of Moses, dishonoring your parents was something worthy of death? How many of us would be worthy of death over that one? Now, again, no one knows for sure what Jesus wrote in the dirt, but whatever he wrote, that, along with his statement, let him who has no sin cast the first stone, it did something ultra convicting in their hearts. They became absolutely aware of their own hypocrisy and realized their own sinfulness. They were not righteous at all. Verse 9, then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the last. I wonder if Jesus had written the names out, starting with the oldest and working his way down. And then the rest of verse 9 says, and Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. I think in this passage, we see the requirements for any of us who want to stand in the position of judging and condemning others. Did you catch the requirement? It's perfection. It's sinlessness. Now, let me ask you, do you qualify? I can tell you for sure, I don't. But it's interesting how quickly we as human beings can behave like these Pharisees. Have you noticed how it's easy to kind of slide through life at times, not thinking much about our own sin? We excuse it in some way. But when it comes to someone else, maybe committing the exact same things that we've committed, that's when we have a problem with it. Think about this. Think about driving down the road during rush hour, and that guy you call an idiot in the other car doesn't plan ahead. He ends up cutting you off, barely giving you any space as he makes his turn, boom, at the last fraction of a second. What do? We say, look at that idiot. Then we yell at him, hey, buddy, who taught you to drive, you moron? But put the shoe on the other foot. What happens when you are driving along and you're kind of spacing off a little bit, your turn kind of sneaks up on you, and at the last second, you whip over there to make the turn and cut someone else off? That's when we want all sorts of mercy and grace. That's when we give the little wave and the smile and we mouth the words, oops, sorry, my turn just kind of sneaked up on me. Happens to everybody, you know, my bad. If it's someone else, they're a stupid, careless, selfish idiot. If it's me or you, oh, it's not so bad. The turn just sneaked up on us a bit. Our own sins always look so much worse on somebody else. Verse 10, when Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you? Jesus stands up. The accusers are all gone. He looks at her and he says, woman, where are your accusers? I love the fact that unlike most of us, he doesn't call her any names. He doesn't put her down. He doesn't insult her. He doesn't rub her nose in it. He didn't say, hey, dirty sinner, where are your accusers, you adulterous slut? No. The word he used to refer to this woman is the same word he used when he referred to his mom and called her woman. Same word in the original language. Where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you? He's speaking to her with respect. Verse 11, she said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Now, in our last study, I had you write down the words, neither do I condemn you. And I had you just focus on those. And we talked about them a lot. Neither do I condemn you. My friend, Christ did not come to condemn me or you or anyone else. He came to save us, to rescue us from what we were hurled into in Eden when Adam sinned. And we've all been born into this condition. And he came to save us from it. And then he tells her, go and sin no more. Simple translation of that, learn from your mistakes. He didn't say, give me 50 Hail Marys and 45 Our Fathers. He didn't say, once you've cleaned up your act for 6 months, then maybe it will be acceptable for you to fellowship with the good people. No. He said, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. No beating her down. Again, no calling her names. No rubbing her nose in it. It says, go and sin no more. I don't condemn you. As I look at Christ, I realize I've got a lot to learn. And as I look at Christ, I realize once more how absolutely amazing grace looks and how amazing grace is when it is really lived out. Now, little rabbit trail or a side note for you. You may or may not have noticed something interesting about those verses we've looked at over our last couple of studies. Depending on the translation, these verses may have been in brackets in your study Bible, or maybe even italics, or they may have simply had a footnote connected to them at the bottom of the page saying something like, NU brackets chapter 7, verse 53 through chapter 8, verse 11, not in original, they are present in over 900 manuscripts. And you would probably see that and say, well, what's that mean? Well, in a nutshell, it means that the manuscripts that were used in making the translation that you're reading didn't contain those particular verses. And so because some of the older manuscripts that have been found don't contain these verses, scholars argue about the validity of them, but they will still include them because they are in some manuscripts, but they will make these footnotes or put them in brackets or italics. Now, the big question is, since these verses are not in some of the manuscripts, does that mean that what we just read didn't really happen? Or was it something that did happen, but which had been handed down orally and was then added later? Well, let me read you some commentary that was written by a guy named A.E. Nock about this passage in his Concordant Commentary of the New Testament. As he talked about the fact that the manuscripts used in translating the Concordant version did not contain these verses, he said, "Nevertheless, the story is so fully in harmony with the grace of Christ that we question whether it could have had any other source." In other words, he's saying the account is so Jesus-y, it's so in line with Christ, and so contrary to the religious natural mindset of man, that he couldn't imagine it not being something that had happened. He's saying it had to have happened. At the end of John's gospel, John says something like, "Jesus did many other things not contained in this book." And John supposed that if everything Jesus did was recorded, there wouldn't be enough books to contain it. So most likely, this account is one of those things that John had not originally recorded, but had happened, and then someone, as they were making the manuscripts, added it in the proper timeline in John's gospel. A. Enoch said about this, "Hence we are constrained to class it among the many things which Christ did, which there is no inspired record." In other words, it wasn't part of the original writing of the Apostle John. Now, I know some people get really uncomfortable with someone like me even bringing up the fact that there are differences in manuscripts and that some of what you read in some translations may or may not have happened, or at the very least, it may have happened but wasn't recorded in the original writings and was added later. People say, "Oh, you shouldn't bring that kind of stuff up." Why not? It's the truth. It's just the way it is. There are differences in manuscripts, and there are issues with our English translations. You line them all up side by side, and you will see some differences. That's just the reality. And when you get down to it, some of those differences of translations, I believe, have to do with the theological bias of the translators, which affects which words they use in translating. Anyway, why did I go into all of that? I guess it was just on my mind when I hit the record button today. I'm James Flanders. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with me. Please pray for me. I need it. I truly do. And I promise you, I will be praying for you, even if I don't know your name. I pray for everyone who visits this site. Be blessed, my friend. Be blessed.